hello to all my fellow 101 History podcast listeners out there. It's great to be back on the air with you guys. And what do you all know? It is hard to believe that this episode of M. William Phelps's Nathan Hale, The Life and Death of America's First Spy, is the epilogue. That's right, folks. We are now at the end of this book topic podcast series. Right before I came on the air, I looked back to see when I officially began this series. It was last year, about 2 weeks before Christmas, December 10th of 2023. That means, folks, that we have been discussing this series now for about 7 weeks and 2 days. I don't find anything wrong with that. But then again, a journey itself takes time. A journey itself doesn't happen overnight. Stories, no matter how big or small they are, with the end result, no matter where that end result goes, it's really a work of art onto itself because, yes, you want to get the answers. Yes, we want to know the truth. But finding all that information out should not be something that just happens overnight. Sometimes, you know, we have to dig deeper into the truth to understand how significant the truth itself really is. You know, it's so easy to have assumed that in this book topic series that, well, we already know that, okay, the title is The Life and Death of America's First Spy. More often than not, maybe some people would have preferred to have focused on the death of Nathan Hale. But I think it's also important that we learned as much as there was about whom Nathan was prior to his death. And why, you know, for one, why he died, but secondly, why it might still matter, even to this day after almost 248 years. I mean, it is hard to believe that this September, I mean, I shouldn't even be thinking that far out in advance, but it is hard to believe that come September 22nd of 2024, it will mark 248 years since Nathan Hale was executed. And knowing that he, you know, most likely, of course, historians don't know what he obviously said, but they obviously have a good indication that his last words were the following: "I regret that I only have but one life to lose for my country." Yes, as tragic as it was that Nathan Hale only did have one life to lose, ended up with only one life to lose for his country, we have to wonder going forward, in the midst of all the uncertainty, the highs and the lows within the New York campaign, how will Nathan Hale's legacy be remembered by those who served with him? How will his legacy be preserved going forward for future generations? And I think it's important that that we all keep Nathan Hale in our minds. You know, maybe not on a daily basis, but whenever we're watching documentaries on television about the Revolutionary War, or whether we are on a trip somewhere where we're visiting, most notably, say, up north in Massachusetts during the siege of Boston, and in New York, where battles took place in New York City around before and up around the time when Nathan sadly lost his life. I think it's fair to say that if we're in New York City, we're walking on 3rd Avenue anywhere between 46th and 66th Street, we should be reminded that someone was executed, but that he was willing to die for what he believed in, and the greater cause being independence from England. And not just so much independence from England, but the greater cause being freedom. Freedom to not live under a government that was more concerned about imposing harsh rule on subjects 3,000 miles away across the Atlantic Ocean. And not just, you know, 3,000 miles away, but live in a better world where government was to be made up of laws but and not of men. Government where people would be allowed to have their voices heard, where consent would be provided. Basically, you know, for Nathan Hale, he wanted an America where there would be essential and alienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Of course, for Nathan Hale, he knew that that this couldn't have been achieved overnight, but that it was going to have to take something greater, and that being partaking in the greater effort by fighting against the greatest military power on the actual battlefield. And not just on a battlefield, but by going behind enemy lines and knowing, okay, there is a 50% chance I might come home alive, but there's always a chance that something might happen to where I might not make it out alive. But even if I didn't make it out alive, I should also be reminded of the fact that I didn't leave anything on the table. So there are a lot of things that, as tragic as it is that Nathan passed away so young under some very unpleasant circumstances, I think that it would be fair to say that he did accomplish a lot in the short amount of time that he lived. I mean, yes, 21 is very young, age 21 that is, but I think there's no doubt that Nathan Hale did accomplish a lot in the short time that he lived. But we will certainly learn more in the epilogue about the legacy he left behind, but we will also need to learn about some other figures whom have been mentioned quite a bit. And it might be interesting to know that, okay, yes, Nathan died very young, but how did others fare whom he came into contact with? Did they live a nice life after the Revolutionary War ended? And what legacies did they leave behind? So I think it's fair to say that we better get the show on the road, as we are now into the epilogue of Nathan Hale, The Life and Death of America's First Spy by M. William Phelps. I will say, folks, that it's been quite a great journey, but it's been a journey well worth pursuing, because I myself had heard of Nathan Hale before, but I really didn't know much about him other than the fact that he was a spy. So even I can say that I pursued a mission to learn more about America's first spy. And it was a great investment. And I know that all of you who've been listening to this series have certainly reaped those rewards. So here we go with our first lead-off question. Was Nathan the only sibling within his family to die in the Revolutionary War? It turns out, folks, that the answer to that question is a yes. Although Nathan did have multiple brothers, including a stepbrother, whom had joined in the cause prior to his going behind enemy lines, Nathan did have contact with one of his brothers, including a stepbrother, right before he went behind enemy lines. But even his own kin did not know of this mission. But then again, being a part of Knowlton's Rangers, anything that Nathan did within the group, it was considered top secret. I mean, after all, Nathan going behind enemy lines, you know, was the equivalent of a modern-day CIA covert operation. Now, three of Nathan's brothers, whom participated, or I should say whom took up arms against the Crown during the Revolutionary War by having fought in actual combat, three of Nathan's brothers all died within 10 years after the Revolutionary War came to an end. His brother Joseph in 1784, Billy in 1785, and Richard in 1793. That means, folks, out of the three brothers whom had all died within 10 years after the war ended, Richard was the only one that got to see the United States alter its course in terms of a new governing document. For all three of them, they did live under the Articles of Confederation, but only Richard got to see the end result, where he got to see, along with many others, that the Articles of Confederation was no longer relevant, that something better needed to supersede the Articles of Confederation. And so, yes, think of what Richard saw in the post-Revolutionary War era. Not only was he part of history where he got to learn that a new governing document did, in fact, replace the Articles of Confederation, being the Constitution, which back in September of last year celebrated its 236th anniversary. Richard also lived long enough to see George Washington get sworn in as America's first president. Richard also lived long enough to see the Capitol start out being in New York, and then all of a sudden get switched to Philadelphia, where it remained as our nation's capital until 1800 under what was the Residency Act of 1790, which gave Philadelphia the seat of the nation's capital for a 10-year period until 1800, as a compromise was reached where the Federalists, and primarily the Northerners, I should say, were able to get the Bank of America, I should say the National Bank, chartered. And as for the Southerners, they were able to get the Capitol at its new location, which would go into effect in 1800, being Washington, D.C., given that it was a halfway area, halfway point between what we know as Pennsylvania just to the north, Maryland and Pennsylvania just to the north, and Virginia just to the south. So a lot of things were taking place, but how ironic that one of Nathan's brothers, Richard, lived long enough to see all of this. I'm not sure how old Richard lived to be, but just the fact that he lived long enough to see the new United States Republic emerge. Yes, the young republic certainly had its share of challenges, but he lived long enough to see a new experiment take place. An experiment that that is still in existence today, even in these turbulent times. Now, as for Joseph, Billy, and Richard, given that the three of them died within 10 years after the Revolutionary War had come to an end, their causes of death were never officially known, but most historians do believe that they all died from consumption, and that has nothing to do with alcoholism, folks. Consumption, most of you know, but for those of you who don't, a good reminder, consumption in colonial times was referred to as tuberculosis, bacterial disease affecting the lungs. Now, we forward to the year 1802. Most of us would know this, but for those of you who don't, Thomas Jefferson became president in 1801. And so therefore he's by this time, he's into his second year in office. And when I think of the year 1802, a military institute was established, not in the South, but up in the North, in New York State, along the Hudson River, still in existence today, West Point. Or as some people refer to it as the United States Military Academy. But I would prefer to call it as West Point, but West Point was established in 1802. But also in the year 1802, Deacon Richard Hale, Nathan's father, passed away. He lived to be 85 years old, which was very unheard of in that day and time. But however, I have learned, based upon what historians have often said and what I even learned at Colonial Williamsburg once many years back, that people who lived in New England were more likely to have a longer life expectancy than, say, people living most notably in the lower South. And what do I mean by the lower South? How about South Carolina and Georgia? So it's very fair to say that many New Englanders had a greater chance of living to be around the age of 50 or just over. Most people in the lower South, if they made it to age 50, it was very unheard of, but the chances of living a very long life were much slimmer. But for Deacon Richard Hale, he lived to be 85 years old. He lived a quarter of a century after his son Nathan's execution, which had taken place back on September 22nd of 1776. So, you know, yes, a parent should never have to outlive their own child, but we do have to be reminded, even in colonial times, that many of parents did outlive children. I mean, that's why husband and wife probably had 10 and 12 children, with the hopes that five or six would live to adulthood. But, you know, Nathan Hale didn't die from disease, folks. He was, you know, sadly executed for going behind enemy lines. And, of course, I'm sure that Deacon Richard Hale never envisioned that he probably would have outlived one of his own sons. He did. As a matter of fact, he outlived four of his sons. I wonder if any of his sons outlived him. Despite his tragic death, going behind enemy lines, what really mattered more than anything else to Nathan? How about securing freedom from England, no matter how big or small the obstacles presented themselves? That's really what it was all about for Nathan. It wasn't about, oh, look at me going behind enemy lines. Aren't I the stud? No. I'm going behind enemy lines because I stepped up to the plate. Sure, there were those who questioned me for even doing this, but it was a call of duty, a call of honor, a call of sacrifice, a call that most people wouldn't do, but yet somebody had to go behind enemy lines. Somebody had to be willing to risk their own life so that others, whether they were part of Knowlton's Rangers, in the Continental Army, everyday ordinary citizens, could live in a world where freedom would prevail over tyranny. From being well-educated to having a strong, deep faith, as well as being regarded as an old-fashioned school teacher, Nathan was someone whom wasn't afraid to forego a career. And his career, folks, was that of being a teacher. Yes, he loved being a teacher, but yet there was a greater calling that superseded that of being a school teacher in a time of crisis. And that greater cause had to take precedent over what he loved most in teaching, and that was fighting for freedom against the mother country, being England. Now, I think we all have to make sacrifices in life, or we should, because if we don't make sacrifices in life, then how are we going to be perhaps better well-rounded as time progresses? How are we going to learn how to step up to the plate when others around us aren't willing to do so? And if we don't step up to the plate, then what kind of example are we setting for those around us? Yes, some people may not really appreciate it, but others would. So we all have to make sacrifices, big and small. And yes, sometimes those sacrifices might not always be to our advantage, But at the same time, if we're smart enough, we can learn from them so that we can modify whatever happened in the past that wasn't to our advantage and take it into a different setting so that we come away a better person than we did before. A unique trait, or I should say a talent, which Nathan possessed prior to answering the call of duty in fighting for liberty pertained to placing Christian values above everything else, along with the belief that man performed at his best while serving his country under God's tutelage. So, in other words, it's one thing for a group of men to serve their country, but it's best that they do so under God's tutelage. In other words, under God's direction, God's course. Don't be serving your country and get this false notion of I am me, myself. Do it as a greater cause where it should be us, we, ourselves, and knowing that God is looking over you, God is guiding you in this direction, God is telling you, hey, look, you join this cause, but don't do it for yourself. You do it for the greater good, meaning that you are a part of something bigger and that you go out there on the battlefield, you go out there on a top secret mission with others, you go on a scouting mission to say harass the enemy, but you do it via teamwork. You do it as a team. You don't do it just for your own good. Did British forces remain in place within the city of New York and Brooklyn after 1776 came to an end? They certainly did. And they weren't planning on leaving anywhere else. As a matter of fact, even after 1776 came to an end, British forces were found to be elsewhere, most notably in New Jersey, especially with them enduring defeats at Trenton and Princeton, which obviously saved the Americans in the sense that by defeating the British at the battles of Trenton and Princeton, the flames for independence were rekindled. Morale went from being an all-time low in late 1776 now to an all-time high. Reenlistments have gone up. Washington could not have asked for a better miracle than he had ever anticipated. But as for the British, despite them sending troops, like to say New Jersey and perhaps southward to eventually to Philadelphia, there will still remain a presence of British forces in the city of New York, including Brooklyn, until April of 1783. Here again, we always are led to believe that the war officially ended on October 19th of 1781 when General Lord Charles Cornwallis surrendered to General George Washington. But we have to keep in mind that even though that surrender was monumental, fighting was still going on. For those of you who were with me when we talked about the Battle of Eutaw Springs, the American Revolutionary War's last battle. There was fighting in South Carolina in September of 1781. Although the British won that battle, Nathanael Greene's forces were able to they were able to remove the British, really more so from the back country, to where the only stronghold they had in South Carolina was Charleston. And of course, British forces stayed in Charleston until 1783. So there were a few by 1783, there were a few British strongholds, but most notably in New York, Charleston, and Savannah, Georgia. But yes, British forces were in the city of New York and Brooklyn until around April of 1783. So they were not going away anytime soon, even after 1776 had come to an end. What became of British Captain John Montressor after he conveyed the news regarding Nathan's death to Continental, or I should say rebel officers? Remember, he's the one that met with Israel Putnam. He met with Alexander Hamilton and another officer. He even advised Colonel Webb, whom had taken over as interim commander while Nathan went on the top secret mission to Long Island. You know, as I mentioned before from a previous podcast segment episode, and I'll just say it here again, I still can't imagine being British Captain John Montressor coming over onto enemy lines with a white truce flag, meaning it's a, you know, some people would say it's a peace flag, others would say it's a neutral flag, but the bottom line is it's a non-fighting flag. But I can't imagine coming over onto enemy lines and having to give the news. And Nathan's death did hit Captain Montressor very hard because he did befriend him. He was intrigued by Nathan's sketches, his drawings. He saw how much faith Nathan had in himself, even as his final days or his last day of life awaited him. And as I've said before, I'd say it again, you know, as compassionate as Captain John Montressor was in allowing Nathan to stay in his tent on his last night, as well as allowing Nathan to write letters, those two letters, one to Colonel Thomas Knowlton, as well as to his family, knowing he was tied up. I can't imagine, you know, it's one thing to be tied to your feet, but he was tied to his arms, and tied to his hands, I should say, and he's still able to write out letters. I mean, I will give Captain John Montressor credit for being compassionate, and he did all this when, Major Robert Rogers, the man who captured Nathan, wasn't present. Had Robert Rogers been present, I don't think he would have allowed Captain John Montressor, under the slightest of circumstances, he would not have allowed Captain John Montressor to display any kind of empathy or compassion for the captured prisoner. But as for what became of British Captain John Montressor after conveying the news regarding of Nathan's death, he did remain under General William Howe's staff, serving in different roles, most notably chief engineer. The year 1777 saw him partake in various military engagements within New Jersey, including Brandywine, Pennsylvania, about 30 miles south of Philadelphia around Chad's Ford, in case any of you are wondering where Brandywine is. Later that year of 1777, Captain John Montressor oversaw construction of new fortifications for Philadelphia, as well as a pontoon bridge at Gray's Ferry along the Schuylkill River. You know, when I was in Philadelphia 3 years ago, I had heard of that name for the river, but I always called it the Schuylkill River. Quite a tongue twister, to say the least, but someone politely corrected me and said, you know, I take it you're from not from Philadelphia, and I said, that's correct, and the person said, that's okay, but if it makes you feel any better, I'm a native of this area, and how to go about pronouncing the river is Schuylkill, and that is spelled, folks, S-C-H-U-Y-L-K-I-L-L. It's a funny way of pronouncing it, but believe me, that's how you pronounce it, Schuylkill. So, yes, Captain John Montressor did oversee construction of a pontoon bridge at Gray's Ferry along the Schuylkill River. March of 1779, he resigned from the army and returned to England. And 20 years later, come June of 1799, at the age of 63, he died. But sadly for John Montressor, he did not die a peaceful death. He died in jail. Not just in jail, folks, he died in debtor's prison. he died with a great amount of debt, and how it worked is if you were sent to debtor's prison, you stayed there until the debts were paid. There's no such thing as Chapter 7 or Chapter 11 bankruptcy. There's no such thing probably as a bankruptcy court. You could have lingered in jail for 6 months at best until, say, the debts were paid. That's if you lived long enough. I mean, there probably wouldn't have been a guarantee that you might have lived a full year until the money was come up with to erase all outstanding debts. So one thing I do know is that many people were known to have died in debtors' prisons because they simply, for one, did not have the money to pay off the debts, and two, they probably died in debtor's prison due to other natural causes of the time. After overseeing the execution of Nathan Hale, where did Robert Rogers proceed onward to with his Queen's Rangers unit? Now we're going to talk a fair amount here about Robert Rogers, and by now we've all learned that he was quite a villain, that he was a real evil man. I mean, it's not so much for the fact that he oversaw the execution of Nathan, but even lashing out at bystanders whom witnessed the execution take place, whom were sobbing, most notably women, sobbing uncontrollably. Only for Robert Rogers to tell them to shut up, and that if they didn't do as he told them to, that he would see to it that they met the same death as Nathan did. So it just goes to show you that Robert Rogers was not a compassionate individual, that he even had a lot of bitterness towards those from within whom shared the same loyalties as he did, being, a loyalist. Not wanting to separate from king and country. So, as for the question of after overseeing the execution of Nathan Hale, where did Robert Rogers proceed onward to with his Queen's Rangers unit? Major Rogers and his Special Forces team or unit went about building multiple forts or posts, including redoubts, or I should say fortifications. One of them in particular that he oversaw, I didn't know anything about this until having read the book and looking it up online. Of course, I don't find anything wrong with Wikipedia. Of course, there was a time when there was no such thing as a Wikipedia, and you actually had to look it up via a large dictionary. But anyways, Robert Rogers was in his Queen's Rangers unit helped helped construct a post or I should say a fortification, most notably at Lookout Place. And what's so special about Lookout Place? Well, it was built during the occupation of Richmond County in Staten Island. And this was the site where General Howe, or I should say General William Howe, planned the takeover of New York City. Secondly, October 22nd, 1 month after Nathan's death, Major Rogers and his Rangers unit, under General Howe's orders, were to seize the abandoned village of Mamaroneck. And for those of you who are curious to know how Mamaroneck is spelled, that's Mamaroneck. So, yes, they were to seize an abandoned village of Mamaroneck, which was previously in the hands of the Continental Army, but Washington's forces were forced to retreat a little bit further north to avoid capture. But by the evening of October 22nd, 1776, British troops within their encampment endured a surprise attack led by Patriot Colonel John Hazlitt's 1st Delaware Regiment. But luckily, Rogers' Rangers came to the rescue and pushed away opposition forces. From what I read, with this battle at Mamaroneck, it wasn't a huge battle, but you could say it was more like a skirmish. But Continental forces actually killed or wounded just shy of 40 British troops. As for the Continental forces, they lost only like 15 men. So I know many of you are probably thinking, well, shouldn't that be a Continental victory just because they lost fewer men? Well, it just so happens that had Rogers' Rangers not come to the rescue and pushed away Hazlitt's 1st Delaware Regiment, then it would have been a victory. So in a sense, it was a tactical victory for the British on the part because of Rogers' Rangers being able to hold their ground based upon where they were positioned and were able to thwart a further advancement of Hazlitt's 1st Delaware Regiment. But, you know, just because we lost, it didn't mean that we didn't lose without excuses. We actually were able to penetrate the British at Mamaroneck, and we were also able to prove to Robert Rogers that, hey, we can fight with you guys. I'm not sure many of the men within the 1st Delaware Regiment had even heard of Robert Rogers. But regardless, even for all the trials and tribulations that the Continental Army has endured in New York, I do have to remind myself, even after having read this book, that there actually were more lights at the end of the tunnel than the opposite, because I always had been led to believe that it was just one route, one debacle after another. And while there were debacles, because this battle or campaign of New York really was trial and error, you could say the same for Bunker Hill and the Siege of Boston, Lexington, and Concord. But we also have to be reminded of the fact that fighting in Boston was far different than it was in New York. And if one asked me why, I would say that a lot of it was loyalties. In Boston, yes, you do have a population that's loyalist, but it's not the same as, say, New York or Philadelphia, because New York and Philadelphia have larger populations than Boston. January 29th of 1777, Robert Rogers leaves the Queen's Rangers. In May of that year, saw the British Army dismiss him due to health-related matters. Health-related matters. I'm wondering, why has he been dismissed? Well, before I tell you all the answer to that question, I do know that General Washington wrote a letter to the New Hampshire legislature expressing his concerns about Robert Rogers' potential return to the home state, being that of New Hampshire. Of course, he was born in Methuen, Massachusetts, which is not far from the Massachusetts-New Hampshire line, but right before he turned the age of 10, he and his family moved to New Hampshire, not far from Portsmouth. So, given that Robert Rogers has spent a good deal of his life in New Hampshire and still has some family there, what would be some of Washington's concerns? Or how about I should say, what would be the New Hampshire legislature's concerns and how did they act on them? Well, the New Hampshire legislature enacted two official orders. Number one, they permanently banned Rogers from returning to his home state. And secondly, they saw to it that a divorce from his wife took place. You know, divorces back then were totally unheard of. I mean, they just didn't happen. Let's just put it that way. So how could a divorce take place here? Well, the New Hampshire legislature determined that Robert Rogers deliberately abandoned his wife. I don't know if he and his wife had children. I don't know. But they also ruled that he had been unfaithful to her. You know, for all we know, he could have maybe been having an affair. That's usually what I think of when someone's been unfaithful. So Mrs. Robert Rogers went along with this. The divorce. She would eventually remarry later to a naval officer named John Roche. She died in 1811. So basically, folks, she lived almost a quarter of a century. You know, she lived just shy of a quarter of a century. Basically, she lived long enough to see the U.S. Constitution replace the Articles of Confederation. She lived long enough to see three presidents complete their terms in office, and she's lived long enough to see a fourth president take the oath of office. And you know, she lived long enough to see Congress pass that infamous Embargo Act of 1807 that pretty much disrupted New England's economy, which was heavily dependent upon manufacturing and mercantilism. She basically lived long enough to almost see the United States declare war on England and fight a second war for independence. I do believe that it's easy for us to forget what people were living, what they saw in the times that they lived in centuries before we as individuals emerged into this world. Their lives weren't dull. Their lives weren't boring. Yes, their lives involved a lot of trying times and sacrifices, but yet they somehow managed to survive. The year 1779 saw Robert Rogers in Nova Scotia help raise the King's Rangers for General Sir Henry Clinton. So why was he dismissed? He was dismissed due to alcoholism. Okay, folks, you know, we do have to be reminded that even in colonial times, that there are those who battle with alcoholism. It's not a, it wasn't something that came about in the 20th century. It's been an issue for a long time. Of course, there's no such thing as AA treatment centers. But as for Robert Rogers, he would eventually get captured by an American privateer vessel, and he would spend time in a New York prison. He escaped in 1782, and a year later, in 1783, he returned to England. But he never overcame alcoholism. It destroyed him. He died in 1795 at age 63. You know, which was old for probably for that time, but he probably could have lived a little bit longer had he not allowed alcohol to consume him. Had he not allowed alcohol to ruin his life. You know, sadly, for people back then, alcoholism was so bad that it not only caused severe fractures within their families, but it also ruined the individual to where the individual simply could no longer help themselves and ultimately resulted in loss of life. Now, he is buried in London, but here's the thing that really blew me away. His gravesite's lost. So all we can say is that he was buried in London, but we don't know where the actual grave site is. You know, here was a man who probably was at the top of his game in terms of being an elite spy. He was well over 10 times the spy expert that Nathan Hale than what Nathan Hale himself could have fathomably dreamed of being. Is it fair to say that despite what happened to Nathan, that Nathan died more of a hero than, say, Robert Rogers Yes, Robert Rogers fell from grace. All of us have grace, but it's how we choose to exercise our grace. And Robert Rogers fell from grace, and sadly, he never was able to relinquish what he had prior to the downfall with alcoholism. What took place in 1992, nearly 200 years after Robert Rogers had died? On a good note, he actually became an inaugural inductee into the U.S. Army Ranger Hall of Fame. Despite Rogers serving under the British side during the Revolutionary War, his establishment of Rangers Network units in the Seven Years' War, or I should say, aka the French and Indian War, helped lead over time to what is referred to as 28 rules of ranging, which in Rogers' lifetime included intense training procedures, live fire exercises, which intended to produce a well-disciplined unit capable of making any necessary adaptations within their surroundings. Robert Rogers is heavily referred to in the Ranger Handbook, which is given to all soldiers in the U.S. Army's Ranger School. It also entails or includes Rogers' guidelines behind irregular warfare fighting tactics. So, yes, we can denounce Robert Rogers all we want, but he should be remembered for having established the fundamental guidelines of how to go about conducting warfare in a non-conventional manner. In other words, instead of always lining up in a battlefield where you're engaging in linear warfare fighting, where you have 10, 12 soldiers per row lined up, firing near one another to get a good volley. While there's nothing wrong with that, you need to do some things a little differently. Hide behind the trees. When you see columns of men coming along the path, gradually, get yourself out from the tree, but aim small, miss small. In other words, aim for the lower part of the opposition soldier's body. But if you miss, at least you're not giving yourself away. By missing small, you still have another opportunity to reload and then fire. Maybe not at that same person, but at someone else. To when you knock them down, you just create a little bit more disruption, but by doing so without giving yourself away. Now, what I want to mention here, we're going to now get back to talking about Nathan, but we now need to find out for ourselves the following. Did Nathan Hale fail to adhere to multiple rules of spying, resulting in his death? Yes, for one, Nathan wasn't strong at showing deceptive traits, given he was too honest and trustworthy of others. Yes, it's important to be honest, and yes, you want people to trust you. But if you want to find ways to deceive those as a means of being one step ahead of them without getting caught, then you're going to have to do some things that are uncommon. Secondly, he attracted attention, given he stood 6 feet tall, which was very unusual for the time that he was living in. From what I learned, especially with regards to the English arriving to Jamestown in 1607, the average height back then in the 17th century for the average man in England was about, say, 5'5 or 5'7. It was very unheard of for any man in that day and time to be over 6 feet tall. Of course, Thomas Jefferson was 6'2". George Washington was at least 6 feet tall. But those are just examples of how, even by 18th century standards, of how unheard of it was for really anybody to be 6 feet tall. So when if you're Nathan Hale going into Long Island and you're 6 feet tall, yeah, you're going to draw attention, but you're probably going to be drawing it for all the wrong reasons. You've also got marks on your forehead, and then you've got a mole on your neck, which is visible. But the mark that was probably the most visible was the powder burn on his right cheek. All too open, visible. If you can't disguise yourself any better, then you're just giving yourself away. Failure to go undercover with forged papers, including an alias. Nathan carried his Yale diploma with his own name attached to the document. He gave himself away. Nathan jeopardized his mission by. This is the kicker of them all right here. Nathan jeopardized the mission. He had everything. He had done everything right, folks. He had gotten the sketches of the fortifications. He had gotten the numbers of what he thought were the numbers behind what Howe's troop numbers were. The mistake he really made, the worst mistake, was that he asked many Long Islanders where their loyalties stood. More questions asked, the greater the attention he attracted amongst the skeptics. For the Redcoats, their phrase was the following: if you spy, you must die. For patriots going forward, should they spy, they must modify going forward. No two settings are alike, but take previous successes and adapt them into new place. What became of Enoch Hale after pursuing the truth behind how his brother died? Given he had a theology degree from Yale College, Enoch, come November of 1778, began his ministry profession by preaching in Westhampton, Massachusetts. September of 1779 saw Enoch become officially ordained, where he served the Congregational Church in Westhampton for 50 years. And from 1804 to 1824, he served as a secretary of the General Association of Congregational Churches and Ministers of Massachusetts. I tell you, I know that Nathan would have been very proud of his brother if he was still alive to have known what his brother had accomplished, knowing that, yes, as painful as it is for Enoch to know that Nathan's not alive anymore. Nathan would have wanted Enoch to have gone about living his life to the fullest, and that's what he has done. The year 1781 saw Enoch marry Octavia Throop. They had eight children. The eldest born son, folks, was named Nathan Hale in honor of Enoch's younger brother. And we should be reminded, folks, that when a child died in infancy, and say their name was John Smith, Sally and Mr. and Mrs. Smith would have gone about having, another child, and if they had another boy, they would have named him John Smith again. This was just as a means of remembering what had happened, say, to the first John Smith, but also it was just a common practice of that time. Nathan, whom he loved dearly, Enoch and his wife Octavia named their eldest born son Nathan in honor of Enoch's younger brother, whom Enoch loved dearly. We go to January 19th, 1837. Enoch Hale, folks, died at age 83. I mentioned earlier, the question of, did Elder Deacon Richard Hale, did any of his children outlive him? Well, one of his sons did. Enoch Hale outlived his father by 35 years. But of course, as I said earlier, you would certainly hope that you would want your children to outlive you as a parent, but that always didn't happen. But Enoch died at age 83 on January 19th, 1837. And Andrew Jackson's finishing his presidency is coming to a near end. So Enoch Hale lived long enough to see America's first seven presidents in office. His son, Nathan, was born in 1784 and lived till 1863. He was 78 years old. He lived long enough to see the Southern states secede from the Union, and he lived long enough to see the Civil War. He lived long enough to see America fractured, but unfortunately, he didn't live long enough to see the war come to an end and see how it would take over time for the southern states to be readmitted back into the Union during Reconstruction. But yes, he lived long enough to see America be engaged in a bitter civil war. And another Hale family member that I'd heard about before and read a story about years ago, his name was Edward Everett Hale. He was an author, historian, and Unitarian minister. He was the grandson of Enoch Hale and the grandnephew of Nathan Hale. He was best known for his work, The Man Without a Country. Edward Everett Hale was born in 1822 and he died in 1909. He lived to be 87 years old, which is very remarkable. Our final question is the following: where is the CIA's headquarters located? Why does that matter? Well, I'll tell you why. The location is in Langley, Virginia. It's not too terribly far from where I live. CIA headquarters in Langley is home to a sculpture of Nathan Hale. The sculpture is meant to remind people that Nathan himself was someone who never showed mixed feelings behind the greater cause at stake, freedom from England. And this past October marked the 38th anniversary. This happened back on October 1st of 1985 by legislation of the Connecticut General Assembly. So it's been 38 and a half years. The Connecticut General Assembly was persuaded by the Nathan Hale chapter of the Sons of the American Revolution to have officially designated as Nathan Hale being Connecticut's state hero. So if you want to know whom Connecticut's state hero is, it's none other than Nathan Hale. The British might have hung Nathan, but through death he became a martyr, a hero. An American soldier whom risked it all for the noblest cause, independence. Independence from England. No matter how hard the risk would be, the sacrifices themselves must prevail over everything else, so that freedom or independence itself can not only be enjoyed by by those of the revolutionary generation, but for future generations going forward. So we must therefore not take anything for granted what those people fought for in the Revolutionary War, but we must be reminded of the sacrifices of those whom did not get to see the end result. In other words, they did not. There were many soldiers whom died not knowing if independence from England was even going to happen. Nathan Hale, he didn't show any sadness as he died, although his regret was that I regret that I only have but one life to live, out that I only have but one life to lose for my country. What Nathan Hale, his life may have ended on September 22nd, 1776, but the greater cause did not. Even in the darkest of moments, as 1776 was nearing its end, it's fair to say that Nathan Hale was watching over George Washington's Continental Army on Christmas night of 1776 as they pulled off one of the biggest surprises that could have been asked for in a time of crisis. It's fair to say that Nathan Hale was guiding the Continental Army everywhere it went, even as the war moved into the southern states in late 1778. Well, that does it for this podcast series, folks. Thank you all for being such wonderful listeners, and I look forward to being back on the air again sometime soon, and wherever we go next, it will certainly be well worth the while. Thank you again, as always. If it weren't for you all, I don't know where I would be, but thank you for being such ardent listeners. Wherever you all may live, stay safe.